This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, which means we'll bring in some of the members of the Northwest Indiana media to talk about the stories that they've highlighted online and in print or on the air. We'll have today from the Times of Northwest Indiana, Giles Bruce, to talk about some medical issues. Also from, we'll hear from LaPorte County from Stan Maddox to talk about some economic development news. Carol Carlson will join us as well to talk about the latest news of the city of Gary and education. And Greg Tejeda will also bring us up to date on some Gary Common Council stories that he's covered for the Post-Tribune. Getting our Reporters Roundtable Thursday underway, let's check in with Giles Bruce, who's a writer with the Times of Northwest Indiana. Giles, as always, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, as always, thanks for having me, Chris.
We've got a couple great stories involving healthcare here in Northwest Indiana that's in print and online in the Times. And the first one here talks about a very important effort that Franciscan Alliance is launching here in Northwest Indiana as part of the effort to fight off the opioid crisis, the addiction crisis here in the region. Tell us about it.
Franciscan Alliance, one of the biggest hospital systems here in the region, had this program down in Indianapolis for the past few years. It's called the GRACE Project, and essentially helps, pregnant women and new mothers who are addicted to drugs with getting into treatment and paying for treatment, as well as, some daily needs, even as something as small as, a hot meal or help with the utility bill, just to, help give these women the best chance to recover from their addiction.
Mm-hmm. Now, since this program called the GRACE Project has been underway for a while outside of our area, did you have a chance to find out from Franciscan Alliance how successful that it's been in central Indiana?
They told me that they have assisted 31 families with a total of $36,000. Mm-hmm. So far, they didn't have exact stats on the recovery efforts of the mothers, but they do believe it's making a difference down there, and they hope it will here too.
That's great to hear. When you deal with problems like the opioid crisis, we hear the national statistics that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, of course, have put out here, and they talk in very general terms, but some cases we need to know more specific issues and how the impact of opioids are on not only pregnant mothers, but on mothers that have given birth to children who, sadly enough, have now picked up the addiction as well, too.
Yeah, well, this is, it's quite an issue in Indiana. I did a story about it back in September about, mm-hmm. The incidence of what's called neonatal abstinence syndrome, which is where the babies are born dependent on opioids, and they're born with these withdrawal symptoms, and they're hard to feed, and they're they cry and scream all the time until they the drugs get out of their system. But at that time I got the statistics, and through the end of this August, 15.7% of Indiana babies tested by the State Department of Health were born addicted to opioids, and that's compared to 10.7% nationwide. So, the incidence here in Indiana is about a third more than across the nation as a whole.
Right. Now, you talk about the assistance in the Indianapolis area that the program, since it's been established down there for a few years, has done. What is, in more detail, is the GRACE Project going to do to help the women that happen to be addicted and, in turn, maybe their children as well, too, to help cover the very high cost of treatment that they're facing?
The GRACE Project will do anything from, try to get these women into treatment and help them pay for treatment above what their insurance will cover, help with some of the high hospital bills, from babies who stay in the hospital because they're born addicted. I have the stats from 2012 from the CDC, but a healthy infant spent an average of 2.1 days in the hospital for a cost of $3,500, whereas a child born dependent on drugs stayed 16.9 days for a cost of $66,700. So there's quite a difference for these babies because they need, intensive care for, for weeks often. So that, you know, this program will help with that. But a lot of what they do is give these women, you know, social supports and education and, you know, just helping them with everyday needs. Like I had mentioned, utility bills and meals and transportation, getting to and from treatment, things of that nature.
Some of these are very, very commonplace occurrences. I mean, people will get assistance sometimes for various projects, but this is one in particular. I guess because we have the issue of the opioid crisis and the addiction problem they have, it just everything, all the problems that they would have just in normal life seem to be heightened considerably more, and it's probably great this kind of help comes out.
Yeah, I think that's the idea of the project, is to take a holistic approach, and as a you know, a Franciscan representative told me, they said it's about helping the whole person. And you know, this is also unique in, is that it's, you know, one of the first, you know, hospital-based programs of its kind in Northwest Indiana. We do have some programs in the region that help, you know, addicted mothers, you know, as far as some of our community mental health centers and community health centers. But, you know, this one, you know, meet the women where they're usually at, getting care and having babies, which is at the hospital. So they should, you know, be able to reach a lot more women.
We're talking with Giles Bruce from the Times of Northwest Indiana on the stories that he's featured online as well as in print in the paper. One of the other stories that we wanted to cover today, Giles, is another story coming out of Franciscan Alliance. This time it's more, I guess, in tune with real estate rather than with health care, but they are related here. We understand that Franciscan Alliance has picked up another hospital site here in Lake County, and maybe it's one that people weren't even aware of. It's been closed for a while.
Yeah, this was a facility called Hine General Hospital, a 35,000 square foot site in Hobart, over at 61st and Lake Park Avenues. It had been closed since 2014. It was a surgical center. Before that, it was a mental health hospital. Franciscan has bought it for an undisclosed price, and they haven't yet said what they're going to do with it, but you know, it kind of fits with what they've been doing in recent months as years. Is you know, part of a pretty aggressive you know, expansion effort. They've you know, been in talks to merge with Methodist hospitals. Those talks are ongoing. They're building a $232 million brand new hospital in Michigan City. They're along the interstate, and then also a near $50 million cancer center in Munster at their hospital campus there.
And that's one area in particular that has grown significantly here. Even in the last couple, 3 years or so, there seemed to be more construction in that area where San Francisco Alliance is setting up more healthcare facilities. There have been a few in scattered places there south of 45th Avenue, but they've really, really gone crazy. You've probably noticed it out there, too, when you head off to the newspaper offices there on 45th. You probably drive past all that.
Yeah, and that's where the cancer center is going up, and they had built that emergency department and expanded that hospital site over there. So they've been pretty aggressive in their growth, as community healthcare system and Porter Regional Hospital before them building a new hospital a few years ago. So healthcare is one of the bright spots for the economy and particularly for the construction market. There always seems to be new buildings, new facilities going up, as there's a big need for healthcare in this area and the country as a whole.
Giles Bruce is the reporter, covers healthcare issues here in Northwest Indiana for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And as always, Giles, thanks for being with us today, and hope to chat with you again real soon.
Okay, will do. Thanks, Chris.
Let's turn now for some news in LaPorte County. We'll turn to Stan Maddox, who is a radio news reporter in LaPorte, and he is also a correspondent as well, too, for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Stan, thanks for spending some time with us today.
You're welcome.
One of the stories we wanted to cover that you've covered as well in the Times and your local media is a story about Michigan City Paper Box Company. They've done something, I guess maybe to some people might seem unusual. It's economic development, to be sure, for Northwest Indiana, but it's kind of a reverse of jobs. Jobs actually coming back into the United States. Tell us about it, please.
Yeah, I guess it's an example of the trend they say businesses have undertaken recently, bringing jobs back from China. after they left the U.S. many years ago. But, yeah, Michigan City Paper Box Company was awarded a five-year tax abatement, $1.2 million in new equipment. That will allow them to do things at their operation in Michigan City that's currently being done in China.
Mm-hmm.
So they will no longer have the need to have the site in China because they can do in Michigan City what the operation in China is doing right now. Of course, Michigan City Paper Box Company has been in Michigan City since 1904, so a long-standing company. Local officials very happy with their commitment, continued commitment to Michigan City. But they didn't say how many jobs would be coming here from China, but they did say 12 projected new jobs result from the new investment, and they currently employ about 87. So they'll have nearly 100 people now working in Michigan City. What's interesting is this is the third or fourth time they've expanded, reinvested in Michigan City since 2011.
Wow.
And now they have two operations in Michigan City. The original operation is on Pine Street, and now they have a location over on Woodland Avenue. So apparently they're doing pretty well.
Do you think that maybe, although they're not related businesses, of course, do you think maybe because of the fact that Pratt Packaging has expanded as it has in Valparaiso with their new plant where they're processing recyclable paper in, that they turn into material in their boxboard plant right next door to the little processing facility, that a lot of this shows that we find these businesses have an opportunity to expand a little over time and where they end. The same way with Michigan City Paper Box Company.
Well, that could very well be. They make packaging for companies like Walmart, Sam's Club, Kmart, Nordstrom, Banana Republic. So if those companies are doing well, then there's an increase in demand for their products as well. They also make little jewelry boxes that some companies use to put their diamond rings and other pieces of jewelry in that go to the stores. So they do a lot over there.
Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of material do they take in the door, so to speak, that they reprocess back into their product, you know?
Yeah, I don't know what type of material they use.
I'm guessing it's just probably just some type of recycled paper material or whatever, you know, whether it's from some recycling program or whatever. So I didn't know if there's any, if they get special scrap from certain businesses around the region or not, or whether, so I thought I would ask. Okay.
The new investment's going to allow the company to have a new e-commerce site. So customers can go to the e-commerce site and customize and design their own boxes and then place orders for those boxes directly online. So that's kind of a interesting new feature that company will have here pretty soon.
Did the City Council of Michigan City have anything to say about this when they had it up before their meeting to consider this tax break?
Yeah, they were absolutely thrilled. One councilman, Don Przybylinski, emphasized the jobs coming back from China. He thought that was very interesting because he's in the steel business. And for 37 years or so, he's been having to compete with China and other foreign countries because of the foreign steel. So he knows firsthand about that competition and how tough it can be. So he was absolutely elated about the fact that jobs from China are coming back not only to the United States, but Michigan City as well.
That's great. That's great. Have you learned if the Indiana Economic Development Corporation is going to offer any assistance as well, and any kind of performance-based bonuses and the like a lot of businesses typically do if they get a tax break?
Yeah, I haven't heard anything from the state of Indiana what they're doing or might not be doing with this tax abatement. Being $1.2 million, maybe it's too low of a number for the state to get involved, but I haven't heard anything about Indiana's involvement yet.
Well, it might be another part of the story that'll develop sometime in the future. That's true, too. One of the other stories, Stan Maddox, that you've been working on and have put out there, well, is about the woes these days of an employee who was with the Indiana Department of Correction who's now in trouble and playing for some type of impersonation charge. Tell us about that.
He's an employee at Camp Summit. Of course, that's just outside La Porte. Camp Summit for years has been a boot camp for juveniles. Recently, the DOC decided to relocate the boot camp downstate and then take a women's prison from the southern part of the state and make that at Camp Summit. So Camp Summit shortly will become a women's prison. Well, anyway, this man works at Camp Summit, and a police officer saw that he had flashing blue and red lights. The lights were in his grill and on the dashboard of his personal vehicle. So the deputy performed a traffic stop. The man revealed that he was employed by the Department of Correction and claimed that there was an emergency at Camp Summit that he had to get to.
Right.
Well, the officer didn't, he didn't want to stop the guy for long. He let him go. He followed him to Camp Summit just in case there was an emergency, and then got it confirmed that there was no emergency whatsoever. Got it confirmed that he had no authority whatsoever to have such equipment in his personal vehicle. I guess some Department of Correction employees do have authority to have flashing blue and red lights, but he didn't have any authorization to do so. So he's in a little bit of trouble. He's charged in LaPorte Circuit Court with official misconduct and impersonation of a public servant, and both of those charges are level 6 felonies. Mm-hmm. So he's in a little bit of hot water. His name is Austin Johns, 20 years of age, just 20 years of age. He lives in Monon. Not sure exactly why he would allegedly do such a thing unless he just wanted to, you know, for the thrill of it, pretend to be a police officer.
It's hard to say.
He didn't say that he was in a hurry because there was an emergency, but as the police said, they got to confirm there was no emergency situation whatsoever.
Stan, one last thing I wanted to check on here was another story that you had on it recently, and this involves, I guess, an upcoming Michigan City Democratic Precinct caucus that's going to be held to fill a seat on the city council. That had to be filled because of the unexpected death of one of the council members. Tell us a little bit about Al Whitlow and a little bit more about this caucus.
Well, Al Whitlow was a very distinguished member of the community. He had been a graduate of Elston High School in 1957. He came back to Michigan City, became a teacher, and he was actually an assistant coach on the 1966 Elston High School basketball team that won the state championship.
Yeah.
And then he went on to become a school principal in Michigan City, later an assistant superintendent for a short period of time. And he was also executive director of the Boys and Girls Club in Michigan City for at least 10 to 15 years. And he just had a reputation for being genuinely concerned about people, especially youth, and he worked closely with youth to try to point them in the right direction, and he had been doing that for many, many years. And so a very, very saddened community by the loss of Mr. Whitlow, because a lot of people had told me that if there was one person that any community would like to have, it would be Mr. Whitlow, because of his good public service work in the Michigan City community for so long. He had been on the city council for about 2 years. He had served one previous term on the city council back in the early 80s, so he was in his second tour of duty on the city council. When he died unexpectedly, he died in his sleep, so everybody was kind of caught off guard. He was 78 years of age, but very healthy looking, so a lot of people were definitely surprised by his passing.
And so this caucus is going to be held sometime in the middle of December, I understand.
Yeah, I believe it's December the 20th. Yeah. The Democratic Precinct Committee people will gather and elect a replacement. Now, his position was at large. He was councilman at large. And, of course, at large means you represent the whole city. So
right.
All the precinct committee people will be gathering to elect his replacement in the coming weeks.
Any clues to, if there's any candidates? People have expressed their interest in being a city councilman at large?
Yeah, I haven't heard any names mentioned yet. The caucus was just recently called, so I'd imagine in the next couple of days more names would be popping up for discussion. But I'm sure there will be some interest, no question about it, being an at-large position, Michigan City kind of being an up-and-coming community. So who knows? They might have a half a dozen candidates or so seeking that seat.
Well, there's plenty of time left, I know, before the caucus and for people to put their names in, put their applications in, so to speak. So Stan Maddox is a LaPorte area radio news reporter, and he's also a correspondent for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And Stan, as always, thanks for spending time with us today.
All right, Chris. You're very much welcome.
This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Let's turn now to Carol Carlson, who writes for the Post Tribune here in Northwest Indiana. Carol, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
We've had some great stories involving the Gary Community School Corporation. In fact, a couple big stories here. The one I know was kind of a follow-up to keeping an eye on the problems that seem to be plaguing not only academically but financially the Gary School Corporation. And the latest, I guess, we can talk about first here is about plans by a couple of the elementary schools, the two that apparently seem to be the most in trouble academically, to try to help the youngsters and in turn boost their own performance in school. Tell us about that.
Well, the district, under the supervision now of an emergency manager, has launched a tutoring program at two of those schools, and those are Marquette in the Miller section and Beveridge Elementary. The schools are in the final stages of state sanctions because of poor performance
mm-hmm.
over the years. And those tutors meet with students for 2 extra hours. They've extended the school day. And what those tutors are doing is reinforcing students' knowledge in the areas of math and English.
Those seem to be the two major areas that that Beveridge and Marquette elementaries were having problems and getting such failing grades from the state?
That's correct. Those are the two main—well, what it is it's related to the ISTEP or standardized test scores.
Uh-huh.
And those are the two main categories on those. On those tests, so the district wants to bring the students up to where they can improve those scores.
And I suppose whenever the state Department of Education changes over the testing from ISTEP to iLearn, I believe is the successor test to it. So at least they'll hopefully be in better stead to be able to do better on the new test when it comes out.
This will be the last year for the ISTEP. They'll take that in March. Mm-hmm. So they are really putting a lot of effort into.
I guess the next question is, well, the school corporation has a lot of financial problems. Who's paying the bills for these tutors?
They are using Title I federal monies for that.
Mm-hmm. How many students are signed up at least so far? Now, I know this is brand new, so obviously that they've just gotten started getting the word out to parents to encourage their youngsters to take part in this extended day so they can pick up the extra extended education as well, too. How many students are involved?
They have about 200.
About 200, okay. I'm sure that they would eventually love to have all of the students. They hate to say have all the students stay over a couple extra hours, but they probably could use the help.
They would indeed, yeah.
What kind of words has Dr. Hinckley mentioned to the State Board of Education about this to let them know about the issues that they're at Marquette as well as in Beveridge Elementary Schools?
Well, she has told them that there are serious academic problems,
yeah.
But they pretty much already knew that. And she's addressing the problem primarily, I wouldn't say primarily, but she's really working hard with teachers to allow them to use data and inform their teaching with data. So certain weaknesses in their students can be pinpointed and addressed and hopefully corrected.
Yeah. And one point that you mentioned in your story that I found was interesting was the fact that apparently Gary Elementary School students, on average, are not in school for as long as in some of the other school districts in Northwest Indiana. How'd you come about that?
Yeah, for some reason they go about 30 minutes less than other schools,
mm-hmm.
and I guess it is within the parameters of state law, but it probably should be extended that extra 30 minutes.
I imagine probably some of it has to do with transportation issues because the schools and the Gary School Corporation are spread out across the city, which the city is still the same size it was from the glory years, I suppose you could say.
Yep.
And
yep.
As for the fewer schools, but a lot longer to be able to get students to school, so you have to allow for that time too, I would imagine.
The big city.
One of the other stories involving the Gary Community School Corporation that you had in the paper and online as well too also involves the emergency manager, Dr. Peggy Hinckley and the school district, but it's about the discussion that had been mentioned not long ago about from Dr. Hinckley's staff about how many schools should be actually in operation in the Gary School Corporation. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, she feels that there are, she hasn't hidden this opinion or anything. She's been up front with it. She says there are too many high schools to sustain a district of 4,700 students. Of course, they have 3 high schools. And one of them is already been taken over academically by the state, so its status is kind of up in the air.
Right.
There's been hope that school, which is Roosevelt, could be wrapped under Hinckley's direction as well, but that hasn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, I guess, what would be the procedure that would have to be going through, I guess, to be able to do that, since the state already has the takeover control on it right now.
Yeah, the state does, but it's Hinckley has to answer to the Distressed Unit Appeals Board, which controls the finances for the district,
mm-hmm.
and Roosevelt answers to the State Board of Education.
No. So it'd have to be some kind of communication and at least some discussion between the two state boards, actually, to be able to do anything on that.
State entities, okay. Takeover within a takeover.
I know within the same discussion where this all came about here lately, not only had Dr. Hinckley talking with the teachers union, I guess, and other people who attended that particular public forum, but I understand that State Senator Eddie Melton, whose district, of course, includes the city of Gary, and is, of course, the architect, I suppose, you could put it, of the laws that in turn have set up the emergency manager's position there in Gary. What does what does Eddie Melton have to say about at least the idea of having to deal with too many schools?
He's frustrated as well, and he would like to see Roosevelt get folded into the current school system. And the district has to pay close to $5 million a year out of its tuition support, which goes to the private company, Edison Learning, that's running Roosevelt, and it doesn't have a whole lot of say on what goes on there at this point. And if a high school needs to be closed, there's all kinds of conjecture. Will it be Ward Emerson? Many people feel it won't be Westside because that's the school that's in the best shape maintenance-wise out of all of them.
Right.
So, and then you have Roosevelt, which is the oldest of all of them, built in the 20s. But it seems to be left out of the discussion.
One of the stories that you looked at in education here recently and had in the newspaper and online was about the city of Lake Station. They've had some discussion, I guess, and the teachers and the school board have apparently come to agreement on a new contract. Tell us about that.
Yeah, they came to an agreement, I believe it was last month. I'm told, anyway, that it was very amenable negotiations. Teachers did get a little pay bump, and they could get a little more money once the state grades come out and their evaluations are finalized.
As I recall, even this goes back to the latest discussions that was during the time that the school district had asked for, unfortunately didn't receive much of his help from the voters for a referendum, but they did talk about the fact that they felt that the superintendent, Thomas Kripliver, did feel very confident that they were going to do much better on the state grades came out this time here. So I suppose he felt confident to be able to endorse the pay raise.
And what districts have to do now is remain competitive with other districts. So if, say, Lake Station pays $2,000 less than neighboring Hobart or River Forest, teachers are going to want to go to those other districts as
right.
well. So they have to remain competitive. And they all want to get quality teachers, and that's just something they have to do.
One of the other stories that you covered, Carol, I know in print and online, involved a group of students from South Korea that have come to the Purdue University Northwest Campus in Hammond. Tell us about that event and then the program that they have been represented by.
Yeah, these are educators from South Korea. There's, I think, about 20 of them, and they are spending the fall semester at Purdue Northwest taking classes there for their education degrees. And what they're studying is differences between our two education systems in the U.S. and South Korea.
If you will take a minute, and you did this when you did your research and talking with people about this, what seems to be the differences that you noted, at least in the discussion, between the way that South Korean students learn and American students learn?
What they were a little surprised to see in the classrooms in Northwest Indiana is that in South Korea, the class is pretty much led by the instructor or the teacher, and it's sort of teacher-centered. And what they found here was students take a larger role in the instruction, and there's a lot of hands-on learning that goes on and collaborative learning, and the teacher kind of steps aside and is more of a facilitator who guides them along.
Now, with the students, the 14 South Korean teachers that were here and watching the students there at, I guess, a university and other places, what opportunities did they have a chance to learn how a commuter campus university is run? What classes did they actually get to sit in on?
Well, they're actually enrolled in an education class. I can't remember the name of it. Many of them are at the master degree level, and it is it's an education class in which they're studying teaching methods.
Now, how long do you anticipate that they're going to continue staying? I guess through the rest of the semester.
I think they're here through January.
Okay, they are. They're going to make it through at least through the start of the second semester of the year then for Purdue mm-hmm. Northwest. And interesting. What impression did you get in talking with these people and had a chance to talk with some of the teachers who have now turned at least temporarily Purdue Northwest students?
I'm sorry.
What impression did you get about the students themselves? And I call them students, but even though they're adults, they're teachers. They're taking the classes.
They seem to be very impressed with the classes that they visited here, mm-hmm. and the vigor that the students really took part in a lot of the classes. I was with them when they were at Hobart High School. And they went to an engineering class where they learned about weather balloons, and the students actually took the lead and explained how the project worked. They visited several other classes. They spent the day there, and I believe they're going back to Hobart High School next month.
Carol Carlson is a reporter for the Post Tribune, and she spent some time taking a look at the education stories, in particular stories from the Gary Community School Corporation, and talking about them with us today here on Regionally Speaking. Carol, thanks as always for being with us.
Thank you, Chris.
Take care. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Time now to turn to Greg Tejeda, who covers stories for the Post Tribune on some of the stories out of the city of Gary. Greg, thanks for being with us.
Hello.
If you will, tell us first here about the interesting a situation involving the possibility, which is now, I guess, a non-possibility, of a change to the smoking ban in the city of Gary.
They were looking to expand the smoking ban, so we also take in the Majestic Star Casino. Apparently, when the state legislature approved the state regulations, they left certain details up to the individual communities. So Gary does have the authority to ban smoking at the casino if they wished.
Mm-hmm.
And city officials considered it. They went as far as actually introducing the ordinance before the pressure from the casino became intense enough that they backed off the issue.
Now, do we know for sure if this is liable to have come back up again? I know that the folks that I'm sure proposed it, the Smoke Free and the G organization, as they call themselves, were probably a little disappointed that this measure was taken off the table.
Well, some of the council members say they hope the day comes when they can resurrect the issue and won't run into all the opposition that they ran into this time. As far as being able to say exactly, it will come up again in June or in January of 2019, that's probably a little more uncertain. It wouldn't shock me if someday this issue comes up again,
mm-hmm.
and the Majestic Star Casino fights it just as intense.
Now, I know that State Representative Charlie Brown, a Democrat from Gary, who has already decided he is not going to run for re-election next year, and this General Assembly session coming up is going to be his last, has made it known that he is interested in putting in bills to do what he can to get the statewide smoking ban revised and basically take out the exemptions, which is the way he saw it when it went through, finally, a few years ago. But he sat there on the Indiana House floor and saw the exemptions added to his bill, so he wasn't particularly happy at the time. But I know he said he's going to try to make a change and get the ban revised so that there are no exemptions. And I wonder if this might, if that does happen, if that would have any impact on what the folks in Gary would like to do.
Well, I know some people in Gary say this is a legislative matter. Ultimately, it's the General Assembly that's going to have to deal with this issue.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them feel it's actually inappropriate for them to be taking this on piecemeal, you know, bit by bit, especially since even if you ban smoking at the Majestic Star, there's nobody going to be stopping smoking at the Horseshoe or the Ameristar. You know, nobody in Hammond or East Chicago that I'm aware of is particularly interested in addressing this issue.
Mm-hmm. I guess we'll just have to wait and see on this one to be sure. One of the other stories, Greg, that you worked on talks about in the city of Gary that there's a new towing ordinance. I know there was some contention the last time we talked about this, and does it seem that this new ordinance is going to resolve the issues that were brought up in the past?
Very good question. The ordinance doesn't actually take effect until January 1st, in part because all the three towing companies that were doing business with Gary, their contracts have all expired. So technically there is nobody right now doing towing. And right now, the city is in the process of trying to find a new company to deal with and award new contract. And they're figuring that's going to probably kick in early next year.
I'm sure the only people that are really unhappy about that might be the police department, because they probably like to get cars cleared away from the curbs and places, and that's why they were able to take advantage of that. But with no towing ordinance and no towing operator right now, things are kind of on hold, aren't they?
Exactly. Although city official Herb Smith in particular, you know, who's been dealing with this issue ever since he became a member of the council 2 years ago, claimed his point was trying to come up with an ordinance that was more clear. You know, the old problem is that some of the towing companies were charging their own rates. You know, but there wasn't a consistency. It often depended which company actually wound up towing your car, how much you were going to have to pay in order to get it back. Now he's claiming there's a definite set rate written into the law. And in fact, the city even cut the fee from $50 to $25, and you technically have to pay the police first before you can even go to the towing company with a release order to get your car back. So technically the city is cutting the amount of money they'll be getting from this. But the, you still have to pay the towing company. It's like $125 if your car gets towed, in addition to the release fee plus any storage fees if you leave your car there for any length of time.
Oh, I see. And Greg Tejeda, there's one other story that you put together for the Post Tribune that I think is very interesting, and there's some interesting possibilities if they're ever brought up. And that is the one that involves the Genesis Convention Center. And I guess this all came up here during some budgetary maneuvers that happened at Common Council not long ago. Tell us why now the Common Council and the administration's very interested in looking into the future of this great relic.
Well, by the mayor's own admission, the Genesis Center has become a financial drag on the city of Gary. You know, it's just not attracting any events of any significance. It's sitting there empty most of the year. I can't actually remember the last time there was an event in the big 7,000-seat arena. You know, the days of old when there was a minor league basketball Gary that played there, those are gone.
Yeah.
So pretty much that building is sitting there empty, and it's not bringing in any revenue. Something has to change. Something has to be done. And they're trying to figure out what that something is, whether that means pairing up in some way with a local casino, or maybe finding a hotel operator who could operate the venue and bring in events, shows, concerts. You know, these are all ideas that are being tossed out there. They're being pondered. And they're trying to figure out, possibly in the next year, you know, what direction do they go in?
Yeah.
Because also part of the problem is the building is getting, I don't want to say decrepit, but you know, it is 40 years old. It could use some maintenance. They're going to have to put some money into it. But what's the point of doing it if it's just going to keep sitting there empty? You
know, you've got
to figure out some long-range direction.
That's right. Well, I recall in the story that you mentioned that somebody had talked about the fact that what has happened so far in other communities that had their convention centers built about the same time, in this case we're talking back in the 70s at least, that they've all been replaced. They've been torn down, or they've been replaced with newer, more modern facilities. And I guess this shows that there is a shelf life, and I guess apparently with the Genesis Convention Center is probably at that end of that shelf life right now.
And unfortunately, Gary isn't in a financial position right now to just tear this place down or rebuild from scratch. You know, they're probably going to have to do something with the existing facility, whether it's a renovation or something is going to have to happen, and that's what they're hoping to figure out.
I know you mentioned, too, in the story that's in the Post Tribune and online and in print about the fact, I think, that the Common Council President Ron Brewer said, oh, well, I wonder if the folks that own the Star Plaza Theater in Merivale might be interested in taking a look at maybe the possible remodeling or retrofitting maybe of the Genesis Center to use it for the performances that are all going to be gone now when the Star Plaza is torn down.
Well, I do know when I contacted the officials, they hadn't been contacted yet by Gary City officials. So at this point, that's just an idea. It's talk. Nobody's actually reached out or done anything in that direction yet.
Well,
although that's something that could happen in coming months.
Well, that's, I guess, why we look forward to 2018 for one new story that can come up again here. We've been talking with Greg Tejeda, who covers news in the city of Gary for the Post Tribune. And as always, Greg, thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much for being with us here with Regionally Speaking's Reporter Roundtable Thursday. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you, as always, to our reporters who have checked in, from Greg Tejeda of the Post-Tribune, as well as Carol Carlson of the Post-Tribune, and the Times reporters, Giles Bruce and Stan Maddox. And thank you very much for being with us as well. We'll be back with you on Monday.